articles about some of the most fascinating Texans, feature stories covering interesting places and things in Texas, and short pieces that are humorous and thought-provoking. Tune in to hear these stories covering contemporary Texas from the 70s, 80s, and 90s that would otherwise be lost to time. Texas Monthly Archives, Thursday nights at 7, Sunday afternoons at 2, and Mondays at midnight on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 60 and clear. Tonight it will be cloudy with a low in the low 50s. Then tomorrow mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 60s. Tomorrow night clear with a low in the mid 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program covering a wide variety of topics of interest to people with vision loss. I'm Nancy Goodman-Torpey.
And I'm Pete Torpey.
I think the most important lesson that I've learned is build confidence by constantly advocating for yourself. Because the more you do it in the little situations, the easier it will get when things get harder, which those situations will inevitably come up.
And as we'll see, our guest today certainly has no shortage of confidence and has certainly been proactive in advocating for herself throughout her education and career.
We first met Rebecca Alford 10 years ago when she was a high school student. And despite being visually impaired, she went on to win the Intel Science Competition, and we've been following her progress ever since. Now with a recently awarded PhD in chemical and biomechanical engineering, and having started her first job, she will share her experiences with us. But first for our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from Rebecca Alford.
Going back to the point about a PhD is all about becoming an expert, well, before I became an expert in science, I had to become an expert in myself and what I needed. And that gave me a lot of confidence to ask for what I thought I needed in order to be successful. And that confidence is really important.
And speaking from experience, a PhD is also about persistence and having long-range goals in mind that you can be committed to and sustain. Support for Eyes on Success is provided by
Navi Lens, a four-color QR code designed to be located and read from up to 60 feet away without the need to focus on it. Personal places and items can be tagged and shared with family and friends with codes obtained inside the Navi Lens app, available for iPhone and Android. More information is at navilens.com.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. 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 Success.
Let's start by meeting Rebecca.
Well, we're here with Rebecca once again. And for our listeners who haven't been with us for the past 10 years, the first time we interviewed you was almost exactly 10 years ago, Rebecca, when you were in high school. And now you're doing something very different. But maybe you can tell our listeners who you are and a little about yourself.
Sure. Hi, I'm Rebecca. I am currently living in New York City. I am visually impaired. I have a retinal condition that affects my nighttime vision as well as some of my daytime vision. And when we first met, I was a high school student, and now I'm working as a research scientist.
And how do they introduce you at conferences when you're giving your papers these days?
They would introduce me as Dr. Rebecca Alford.
That's pretty impressive.
Thank you.
So you started your new job just a couple of months ago. Can you tell us what it is?
Yeah, so I am a postdoctoral fellow at D.E. Shaw Research, which is a small private pharmaceutical company in New York City.
And you call yourself a postdoctoral research fellow. Can you tell us where you got the doctorate?
Yeah, I got my PhD from Johns Hopkins. I graduated in June of 2020. Might I add, from my living room, thanks to the pandemic.
And thanks to the pandemic, we were able to be in the audience for your thesis defense, which was so exciting.
Yeah, that was really cool.
And when we first ran into you in 11th grade, you weren't married, but now you are.
I am married, and we have a little puppy, Ollie. He's a joy to have.
Eyes on Success is made possible in part by our corporate partners. Underwriting pairs the impact of targeted marketing with the integrity of community goodwill.
Learn more by sending an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net.
This week's focus topic is Rebecca's experiences in graduate school and upon entering the workforce.
As we mentioned in the introduction, we talked to you many times through the years. The first time we met you was when you were a junior in high school, and you went through and won the Intel Science Competition and went on to undergraduate school, and we talked about what some of those experiences were like for you as a visually impaired person. And I guess the last time we talked with you was when you were thinking about applying to graduate school and talking about some of the issues there. Can you give us an idea of what happened when you went to graduate school and how you were accepted with your colleagues and your professors?
Yeah, so graduate school was definitely interesting because I think this is true whether or not you have a visual impairment. Graduate school is a very individual experience, especially with a PhD. Your entire goal is to work toward becoming an expert in your field. And because you're aiming to be the expert, it means that you're encountering a lot of problems and questions for the first time. From a scientific standpoint, I think that the vision-related challenges were relatively easy to tackle because I had a lot of experience working with and asking for the technology I needed to be successful. I think the greater challenges were, I think, maybe outside of the lab. Outside of doing my direct experimental work, there were some new situations that I hadn't thought of. And because you're working in a smaller setting and you're not working directly with a teacher or professor, I had to be more creative in persuading my advisor to make some adaptations.
Can you give us some examples of those?
Yeah, so one common example is our lab had a group meeting every week, and the goal of that group meeting was that we had a rotation and each student would share their research progress and that student would make their own slides. And unfortunately, sometimes when you're making slides in a hurry, the font size can be really small or the colors may not be good. And even for me sitting very close, I couldn't see really anything, and I wasn't always able to get the students to email me the slides beforehand because admittedly I joined the crew of editing your slides until the last minute before group meeting.
That inevitably happens.
So I think finding a way to make sure that I could still participate in Access group meeting without people having to make too many changes, because again, you want to be understanding that they shouldn't need to have their slides ready 2 hours before, definitely presented a little bit of a challenge. Honestly, what ended up happening is my colleagues are just really understanding, and if I ask like, oh, do you mind describing this, I can't see it as well, like they were more than happy to slow down and do so.
And you learned many of those skills very early on. As our listeners may recall in our early interviews and through the years, you've always been very proactive about advocating for yourself and identifying solutions that will work for you.
Yeah, I think going back to the point about a PhD is all about becoming an expert, well, before I became an expert in science, I had to become an expert in myself and what I needed. And that gave me a lot of confidence to ask for what I thought I needed in order to be successful. And that confidence is really important because when you go to someone and you say, oh, I think I might need this, they may not be as willing to do a little bit of extra work to accommodate you. Whereas if you come with evidence and you say this particular modification can help me be more successful and here's why, they're much more incentivized to help you.
Yes, and I think that's a great approach because you know best the solutions that are going to work for you. You really can't count on other people to know what's going to work best for you.
Yeah.
One issue we talked about a number of times through the years was you've been back and forth on the concept of navigating using a cane and your limited vision versus a guide dog. Can you talk a little bit about how you swung back and forth and what your final decision on that was?
Yeah, so one lesson that I learned in college was the kind of living situation that I would need to feel more comfortable and be more successful just as a more independent person. So when I was choosing a graduate school, as well as when I moved there, I made sure that my apartment was in very safe walking distance and also on a route where Hopkins had a shuttle. So if you needed a ride home, they could take you back and forth, no problem. Hopkins campus is also not that large and it's not as bustling as the city of Pittsburgh that I was in before. So it turned out that I was able to safely navigate the campus just with a cane or even during the daytime without a cane, just because I got so comfortable with it. I can tell you that that backfired when I moved to New York City because I lost some of my crucial O&M skills and needed a refresher. But I...
You got too good where you were.
Yeah, well, I walked the same route to the lab every day. I went to the same places and then... I mean, this is going to sound weird, but I met my husband and he started driving me places, so I wasn't walking as many places as I normally would have. So, you know, you adapt to changing lifestyle.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know the feeling. I mean, I don't think I'm nearly as good with a cane these days as I was when I was single. I mean, I'm often with either our kids or Nancy, and, you know, you tend to let those skills lapse a little.
Yeah, so I will say, again, and I think learning from these experiences is so important because just as I had learned things from college, one of the things I learned from grad school is I really liked being in an urban area. It made me more independent. As small of a thing as it might sound, sometimes I want to go get my hair done and not have my husband waiting in the car for me. So I think, you know, moving to New York City became really important to us because it's such an urban area and I was much more motivated to pick up those cane skills and be more independent. Just because that was a goal of mine.
Did you get some additional O&M training or just have your husband walk you around the new areas of New York City in which you're living?
I actually did get additional O&M training. When I moved back here, I was able to call New York State and they were able to get me a couple of O&M lessons just around my local neighborhood. We also intend to do more when I go back into the office to practice the commuting route because I haven't been doing much of that yet.
Yeah, let me tell you, Andrew may be in for some additional involvement here. We both worked at Xerox on the same campus, which was enormous, I mean, a couple miles in each direction. And every once in a while, Pete would have new colleagues in a different building, or he'd have his office moved to a different building. And we would go out over lunchtime back and forth and back and forth and finding a route that would be safe and then teaching it to him.
Yeah.
There wasn't anybody else at Xerox who was going to do it for him, so that was my job.
Yeah, I will say, again, Andrew is amazing. He's so helpful in all things, not just vision-related, and of course I'm grateful to have him. I think it's a balance of finding when I want to depend on somebody and when I want to try to learn to do something myself.
Well, one thing I've learned is before jumping in and helping, I always say, would you like help with that? And the answer is sometimes yes and sometimes no.
Yeah. I will say, though, like sometimes I can be a little bit stubborn. So
really?
Someone might say, would you like help with that? And I might say no. And might say, really? You sure you don't need help with that? I think sometimes I need that extra push.
There is a balancing act to be done there.
Yeah.
So you talked a little bit about the interaction with your colleagues and some of the presentations. What about your interaction with the professors in the department?
My advisor is amazing. Was and is amazing. I had a very good relationship with him, and he was always willing to help adapt to any situation that came up. Definitely, it was much harder working with the other professors for similar reasons in college, that most people don't encounter someone with a visual impairment on a daily basis, much less in a selective graduate program. Yeah, it sometimes took a bit of extra arm twisting. It sometimes took a bit of patience.
And what kind of situations like that were related to your blindness as opposed to what research you were doing and how that was coming out?
Well, I think it was mostly applicable in the beginning of graduate school when I was taking classes, making sure I could get accommodations for those classes. I mostly remember sometimes professors would forget to bring in large materials and whatnot. Again, very similar to college. But because we only take courses in the first or second semester of grad school, it became less and less of an issue.
Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing your research itself, you mostly had under control because you're basically a computer programmer. You do a lot of computer programming, right? And that's very accessible for people with vision issues.
Yeah, that is true. I will say one cool thing about graduate school and just broadening your network is I did get the opportunity to meet other visual impaired scientists. Some who only do computational work, some who even do work in the wet lab. And that definitely opened my mind to a lot more possibilities that there might be for doing research despite having a disability. I still don't want to do wet lab, but I am now in more of the camp that, you know, you can do it if you want to, whereas if you asked me 5 years ago, I would have said, not so much.
Mm-hmm. Were these other visually impaired people you met in your graduate program or in your university, or are these people you network with at conferences and other professional venues?
Yeah, these are people that I network with at conferences.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I met any other visually impaired students during my time at Hopkins. That doesn't mean they weren't there. It just means that our paths never crossed.
You wouldn't have seen them.
That's true. The irony. But yeah, I was lucky to meet a number of great mentors. One person who I think you guys actually connected me with, Bonnie Swainer, who's an epidemiologist at Hopkins. Her and I would meet for lunch every couple of months, and she became a really great mentor to me just in terms of navigating science as a person with a visual impairment, and especially when it came time to pick my next step after grad school. She works with a number of groups. Also, most conferences have some kind of diversity committee, and they're working on making sure that disability falls under that diversity committee, and that's definitely also led me to make a lot more new connections.
It's great to be able to network with people who are facing similar issues, and that way, as you said, you can get some ideas of what can and can't be done, alternate ways of attacking problems or tasks that you need to do, etc.
Yeah, I will say, beyond just the practical aspect of getting other ideas, it's just a comfort to know that there are other people who are dealing with the same struggles, because I think when there are so few of you, it can definitely rock your confidence, and that's something I always appreciated connecting with those people for that reason.
And that's one reason we do the show, because there may be some other young visually impaired student who has visions of becoming a scientist, and hearing your success story, likewise everybody else we've talked to and what they've managed to do, I think gives people a lot of confidence as well as some ideas of how they can achieve what they're trying to achieve.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about the search for employment and how that worked?
So I knew that I wanted to do what's called a postdoc position, which is, in science, it's considered a transitional position. The reason for that is I knew I loved science and wanted to go into a technical field for my career, but I wanted to get a little bit more project-based experience. I basically emailed a bunch of professors who I thought it would be like super cool to work in their lab. I also was contacted by a recruiter from DE Shaw, which is the company I'm at now. And yeah, I just kind of like went through the motions of interviewing and sending resumes and It was really stressful, but then at the end, I luckily had some great options to choose from and ultimately decided to come here.
Many visually impaired people struggle with whether one should tell prospective employees ahead of time about their visual impairment or wait until afterwards or some other point. What was your approach?
I did not.
So you showed up as a visually impaired person, and that was the first time they were introduced to the fact that you had a vision impairment?
Well, okay, so actually, I think I played it differently at each interview, mm-hmm. now that I'm remembering. So the earlier interviews, I wasn't as quick to disclose. Definitely, I would ask, like, if I needed something to be read a little bit bigger or something to that extent, but it wasn't as much of an issue in really any of those beginning interviews. I think I tried at my last interview, I think because I knew that I was leaning toward another offer that I had already gotten, so I thought it was an interesting opportunity to try it out, and it sounds ridiculous. Yeah, the last two interviews I disclosed because I knew I had at least one offer, so I felt a little more comfortable giving it a try. At one interview, it went great, and at the other interview, it was really awkward and uncomfortable.
I guess it's one of these things you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, and I wish that we lived in a world where I said, absolutely, I would feel 100% comfortable disclosing. I mean, the reality also is that, like, my visual impairment is usually included in my biography, which is all over the internet.
Oh, that's true. You have a good internet presence.
Like, somebody could have known, right?
Yes,
like,
yes.
If they were looking. It was really important to me that the focus of the interview was my scientific skills and competency.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted the first question to be, why do you want this job? Not, oh, what is that cane thing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that was my approach when I applied for a job after getting my PhD in graduate school. I didn't tell anybody until they offered me an interview, and I said, okay, when you pick me up at the airport, I'm the guy with the cane.
Yeah.
When I got hired at Xerox, I asked them after I got hired about, you know, what was their impression all of a sudden this blind guy showing up. And they said, well, you know, actually we didn't think about it much. We figured if you were good enough and smart enough to get a PhD, you could probably handle it when you got here.
So I completely agree, and I believe that the places that I was strongly considering, it wouldn't have mattered if I had disclosed. But in the moment when you're applying for a job and you're already anxious about trying to figure out what your next step is, I think that was one anxiety that I wanted to eliminate to, mm-hmm. to make it more comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, again, it's a personal choice.
Yeah, and you never know the reaction you're going to get from the employer.
Yeah.
When we were finishing graduate school and applying for our first jobs, which wound up being at Xerox and we stayed there for decades, the so-called job interview that you went on was an entire day proposition. They'd fly you in, you'd have dinner with them, you'd get up the next morning, you'd spend all day with them, breakfast, lunch, interview, give a presentation. What's it like these days?
It's the same.
It's exhausting.
It's very exhausting. Though not as exhausting as graduate school interviews. Because graduate school interviews are like multiple days, and then you go to many of them. Like job interviews, you probably go to less. And usually by the time you're looking for a job, you've more than not likely nailed down the location, so you're not flying back and forth across the country all the time.
We've interviewed you at each transition in your education from high school to college, from college to graduate school, and at each transition, you mentioned how important various criteria were for you in choosing a location. How did that come into play this go-round?
One thing that happened when I was applying for postdocs is some people believe that for your postdoc, you should just go anywhere, like regardless of the location. And one of the things that I had shared with some of my mentors is that I really wanted a metro urban area, first because I wanted to be closer to family, but especially because I wanted more independence. And that was a point that not all of my mentors resonated with, because they didn't necessarily know what it was like to not have 100% access to a car, and what it would be like to live in a not urban location without a car. And I'm really glad that I stuck to my guns on that one, because I would have been really unhappy if they convinced me to go to like some amazing professor's lab that was in a town that I couldn't navigate. Because even though that would have been an amazing experience, I would have been unhappy and felt restricted. So I think that part is just as important for the job search as the specific place that you end up. I also realize not everyone always has a choice, but if you can have a choice, that's something that you can prioritize.
And that's a good point. As you said, most people just look at the job and the prestige or the money of the job, and they don't take sort of a holistic approach. When I got my job interview at Xerox, I told them that in addition to interviewing the staff and people that I might work with and for, I wanted to see a little bit of the town. And of course, the day got busy and that never happened. And they finally sent me an offer and they said, you know, do you want the job?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I never got a chance to see the town and I really feel uncomfortable moving there without seeing the town. And they flew me up again and just spent the day touring me around town so I could see what it was like, where I might live, how I could get to and from work, to and from the supermarket, etc.
Yeah.
So that is important.
Safety and feeling comfortable is definitely underrated. That's something that I've learned throughout my experiences up to here, and I'm glad that that's something I thought about because it's much nicer now.
Yeah, great. And what an inspirational story. It was a pleasure for Nancy and us to befriend Rebecca and follow her progress over the past 10 years. It just goes to show you that if you have a vision and something you want to accomplish, if you put your mind to it, work hard, and you're persistent, it can happen.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. 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 Success.
Now for this week's final item, how to get in touch with Rebecca Alford if you have any questions. And just as she has been extremely generous with her time and her thoughts and her feelings with us on this show, she didn't mention it, but over the years she has also mentored many younger students and been very generous with her time in that effort as well.
If people wanted to connect with you, if they had questions about your experiences, either going through school or your professional experiences, would they be able to contact you?
Yeah, absolutely.
And how would they do that?
They would email me at rfalford12@gmail.com.
And you said you have a web presence. Do you have a blog, or are you just on LinkedIn and other social media?
I'm on LinkedIn. I don't really do social media. It probably makes me sound like a hermit. But I guess because I work a lot with the Hertz Foundation and a couple other groups, my bio is posted on those web pages. So when you Google me, that's usually what comes up.
They'll find you.
And you mentioned the Hertz Foundation. You neglected that in your introduction of yourself. That is a very prestigious fellowship that you had through graduate school.
I am a Hertz Fellow, and I'm very, very grateful to the Hertz Foundation for helping me through graduate school. The connections I made in that community are just invaluable.
In addition to having Rebecca's contact information in our show notes, if people want to connect with her, we'll have links to all the previous episodes in which we interviewed Rebecca, so you can hear the whole story yourselves if you want to. Just go to www.eyesonsuccess.net. and look for those show notes.
That's it for show number 2112. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be talking about why it's so important to understand your body. Krishna Washburn is a blind professional ballet dancer and an instructor who runs Dark Room Ballet. She believes that visually impaired people could benefit from having a better understanding of how their bodies and body parts work. And we will speak with her about her instructional methods as well as how her online classes work.
We hope you'll join us next week for that episode.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman-Torpy and Peter Torpy, and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio.
You can access the full archive of previous shows, subscribe to the podcast, and much more by going to our website, www.eyesonsuccess.net. If you have questions about anything you've heard on the show or have suggestions for future shows, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net.
Thank you for listening and have a nice day.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Men's Health Magazine, followed by USA Today at 2.
Coronavirus briefs. The West Texas Food Bank has resumed business with a few modifications, according to a press release. The senior pantry at the Midland location will continue to operate 10 a.m. to noon, Tuesday and Thursday, and the emergency pantry at the Odessa facility will continue normal operations on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Clients will be asked to drive through, and WTFB staff will load groceries into their vehicles.
Sure, Paula Deen and Guy Fieri are experts in the kitchen, but would they be able to pull off their delicious recipes if they had no eyesight? Dale Campbell may have lost his vision, but he didn't lose his creativity. Each week, Dale and co-host Cheryl Cummings bring you new recipes and cooking tips, specifically for those who have low vision or no vision on Cooking in the Dark. Wednesdays at 8, Sundays at noon, and Mondays at midnight on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 63 and clear. Tonight, it will be cloudy with a low in the low 50s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 60s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, and welcome to our program. My name is Peter Gilmore, and I'll be reading Men's Health Magazine here on site into Sound Radio. First up, protein, but better. Called a great protein flavor recession. Over the past few decades, something happened to grocery store beef, chicken, and fish. It all started to taste the same. The main culprit, industrial farms producing bland meat and giving animal protein a bad name. No wonder plant-based meat took off. But now smaller-scale farms are raising this how-it-should-be-tasting animal proteins, while also enhancing the nutrition of the products. Better still, you can have them shipped to you. Here are just three of the many producers offering the good stuff, plus how to cook it right. Regenerative Ranching's Underdog. MLB star Adam LaRoche and his business partner have built a forward-thinking farm to bring you an MVP steak. There's one big reason the meat you eat at the steakhouse tastes sublime. Sourcing. Steakhouse owners know that delivering a tender, juicy, belly-patent ribeye, or tomahawk, or whatever, starts not in the kitchen, but on the cattle ranch. Enter Adam LaRoche. When he retired from baseball in 2016, he found himself with plenty of two things, land and time. LaRoche had opened a steakhouse back in 2013 and owned a 4,800-acre ranch in Fort Scott, Kansas. He had big dreams of raising better cattle that would help supply the steakhouse and sustain his family for generations to come. And so, with his business partner, rancher Jack Gross, he co-founded E3 Meat Company. LaRoche and Gross began by looking at the dirt. Healthy earth makes healthy grass, which makes healthy cattle, which makes healthy meat, which makes healthy people, says Gross. Their first change was to introduce paddock grazing, which the cattle eat only choice grasses. Yes, they can discern a difference, rather than consuming all the grass, which is tough on the soil, and poor soil demands chemical fertilizers and herbicides. The ranch also has implemented low-stress cattle management practices, raising the animals without using steroids or antibiotics, and never added hormones. Result? Luscious marble cuts of deeply beefy steak. While grass-fed is trendy, E3 grain finishes beef. That means the flavor is familiar, powerfully hearty and almost buttery, yet elevated, like a chop you're used to have at a steakhouse, only enjoyed at home. Steak packages, starting at $100, are available through E3Ranch.com. Sear roasted beef tenderloin steaks. If you're buying by the mail order, you can often pick up specialty cuts, such as beef tenderloin roast, a massive hunk of lean meat that cooks up so sublime you can skip the steak knife. Fear not screwing it up. Dividing the tenderloin into two roasts is a good option if you have multiple meat temps needs in your home. What you'll need: 1 5-7 pound trimmed beef tenderloin, halved to make two roasts, 2 tablespoons canola oil, 2 tablespoons butter, 2 whole garlic cloves smashed, and 3 fresh thyme sprigs. How to make it? Pat the tenderloin dry with paper towels and allow it to rest at room temp for 2 hours. Preheat your oven to 425. Heat a large cast iron pan over medium heat. Generously season the tenderloin with kosher salt and fresh ground black pepper. Add the oil to the pan. When it begins to shimmer, sear the two roasts on all sides, 3 to 4 minutes aside. Remove the tenderloin from the pan and transfer to a roasting pan. Do not clean out the cast iron pan. Roast the meat according to the chart at right, about 10 to 15 minutes for rare, plus 5 to 10 additional minutes for every level of doneness thereafter. 4. Carefully remove the tenderloin from the oven. Heat the cast iron pan over medium. Melt 2 tablespoons butter and add the garlic, thyme, and roasts. Baste for 1 to 2 minutes. Transfer the roast to a cutting board. Let them rest for about 5 to 10 minutes. Then slice and serve, topping with a little melted butter and pan drippings. This will feed 14 to 16 people. Timing the temp. Pull the meat out of the oven at the right doneness is critical to a delicious meal. Your best bet is to buy an instant read digital thermometer with an alarm. We like the $99 Smoke Remote BBQ Alarm Thermometer from thermoworks.com. Then cook the meat until your desired doneness using the following chart. Rare, 115 to 120. Medium rare, 120 to 125. Medium, 130 to 135. Medium well, 140 to 145. And finally, for some reason, well done, 150 to 155. Remember, as the meat rests, residual heat will continue to cook the beef 5 to 10 more degrees. The temperature above takes this into account. Quick note, consuming undercooked meat, that's below 145 degrees for tenderloin, may increase your risk of foodborne illness. Next, pastured poultry is the future. That's due to its supreme taste, nutrients, and ability to help small farmers grow. If you've been unimpressed with organic or free-range supermarket chickens, paying a few bucks more for a still bland bird, Cody Hopkins gets it. When he started his small farm in Arkansas in 2006, he bought a few chickens to raise for meat, largely because, well, they were cheap. Kind of the way most industrial farm chickens are raised, crowded together in warehouse-like buildings and given feed, Hopkins put his chickens in portable pens. He moved the pens every few days so the birds could peck fresh grass and clover. The simple act infused the meat with bold, almost floral flavors. There's a big difference between our chickens and one raised in a chicken house. Those chickens will never see the light of day, he says. Free range just means the birds can go outside, not that they actually do go outside. And due to their diet, pasture-raised chickens have higher levels of good polyunsaturated fats, when compared with conventionally raised chickens. That's according to research from 2018. Though Hopkins has exceptional chickens, he couldn't find a processing plant that was willing to work with his small outfit. In the U.S., 18 large corporate farming operations, including Tyson, Perdue, and Pilgrim's Pride, controlled estimated 90% of the meat chicken industry. And these companies often own their own processing plants. So Hopkins and other like-minded farmers partnered with a non-profit, Heifer International, to start the Grassroots Farmers Cooperative, a coalition that shares processing resources. The group, founded in 2014, is now run out of 24 farms in 8 states and ships nationwide. Its pasture-raised chickens, a bestseller. It's $21 for a whole bird at grassrootscoop.com. Now, a yogurt-marinated roast chicken. High-quality pasture chicken has an almost herbal flavor. Highlight that by marinating the bird in a herbed yogurt mixture. The acids in the yogurt will help to tenderize the meat. What will you need? Well, 1 3/4 cups of plain Greek yogurt, 1/2 cup olive oil plus 1 tablespoon, 2 cloves of garlic minced, a zest from 1 lemon plus 1 teaspoon of juice, 1/4 teaspoon minced parsley, 1/2 teaspoon minced rosemary, 1 pinch of saffron, that's optional by the way, 3 to 4 pounds of pasture-raised whole chicken, giblets removed, 1 onion, large dice, 3 ribs of celery, large dice, and finally 1 carrot, large dice. In a bowl large enough to fit the chicken, combine the yogurt, 1/2 cup olive oil, garlic, lemon zest, parsley, rosemary, saffron, 2 teaspoons salt, and 1/4 teaspoon freshly ground black pepper. Add the chicken and coat well with the yogurt mixture. Marinate covered in the refrigerator for 12 hours. Second, preheat your oven to 350. Rinse the chicken and pat it dry with a paper towel. Transfer the vegetables to the bottom of a large roasting pan. Sprinkle with sea salt and add the chicken breast side up. Tie the legs together close to the body of the chicken with twine. Rub the 1 tablespoon olive oil all over the chicken and then sprinkle with a tablespoon of sea salt. Roast the chicken until a meat thermometer inserted in the thickest part of the breast and thighs reaches 165 degrees. This should take about 90 minutes. Carefully remove the chicken from the oven. Let it rest for 15 minutes before carving. Should feed 6. This farm salmon is a very good thing. It's fattier, which means more benefits for your health and taste buds. You've heard about all the studies. People who eat fish rich in omega-3 fatty acids may reduce their risk of stroke, heart failure, Alzheimer's disease, and even depression. Yet Americans are still consuming only about 1/3 of the weekly recommended dietary of 8 ounces of fish and shellfish, according to the latest data from the USDA. But the fish farmers behind the company New Zealand King Salmon are raising salmon so delicious that it's hard not to want to eat more of it. And it's all due to fat. After cultivating 9 generations of fish, the company has managed to produce a salmon that has a fat content of 25%. If you were to compare that with wild salmon, it would be between 12 and 15%. And the fattier the fish, the greater the amount of DHA and EPA, 2 omega-3 fatty acids beneficial to your heart and brain. To raise its salmon, the company employs football-sized net pens that are 98% water and only 2% fish. At that density level, the waste is naturally composted, by the organism on the seabed. It does not build up. This method works incredibly well. In fact, Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch rates New Zealand salmon raised in open water net pens a best choice for sustainability. That's even better than wild-caught salmon from the U.S. and Canada. You can order 4 pounds of New Zealand King Salmon under the brand name of Ora King Salmon for $120 from Brown Trading Company at browntrading.com. brownwithanE.com. That's brown with an E, by the way. Now here's a recipe for jerk salmon. The heat and spice in this recipe's jerk marinade tag teams with the richness of a high-fat farm salmon. What you'll need: 1 head of garlic minced, 1 cup chopped scallions, 1 cup cilantro leaves, loosely packed, 1 Scotch bonnet pepper or habanero chili pepper stemmed, 1 inch piece of fresh ginger peeled and chopped, 2/3 cup molasses, 2/3 cup olive oil, 1 teaspoon ground allspice, 1/2 teaspoon ground cinnamon, 4 6-ounce skinless farm-raised salmon fillets, lime wedges for serving. So how do you make it? In a blender or food processor, add the garlic, scallions, 1 cup cilantro leaves, hot pepper, ginger, molasses, olive oil, allspice, and cinnamon. Season to taste with salt. Puree until smooth. In a large bowl, combine the salmon with half the pureed jerk marinade. Turn the fish to coat well. Refrigerate for 15 minutes. Reheat your oven to 375. Place the salmon on a non-stick baking sheet. Pour the rest of the marinade over it and roast until flaky, about 8 to 10 minutes. Serve the lime wedges and some cilantro sprigs. Feeds about 4 people. I need to take a break here to remind you you're listening to Men's Health Magazine on site into Sound Radio. You can listen to Sight into Sound on channel HD4 on 88.7 KUHF, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or smartphone, as well as on Amazon Alexa and Google Home devices. You can also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at sightintosound.org. We are Sight into Sound Radio since 1967. Next up, escape burnout. The pandemic has blurred the boundaries between our work and home lives, leaving many of us exhausted, cynical, and inefficient. Here's how we all can reboot this year. We'll give you the good news first. Surveys show that one side effect of the pandemic is that we're all more productive.
Whoop, whoop.
The bad news: some experts think it's because so many of us are working longer hours. An American psychologist, Herbert Fronberg, first popularized the term burnout in the 1970s after observing overworked staffers at a free New York City-based health clinic. He characterized burnout, the feeling of extreme fatigue, as a response to overwhelming stress and expectations. During the 2000s, the word would be used to describe any feelings of frustration, not those solely caused by job stress. For example, election burnout, work burnout, the list goes on. But 2020 brought us a new kind of burnout, as millions of Americans began working from home indefinitely. A year later, we're really feeling the effects. The 3 signs of burnout are exhaustion, cynicism, and inefficiencies. That's according to Dr. Jaquita Jimenez. And because society tells men they can't be tired or inefficient, they often push through, and that exhaustion becomes anger or irritability. Your tolerance takes a dip, and now you're annoyed by your coworker, or you insist the project you're working on is stupid. Burnout has been linked to several serious health conditions, including heart disease, high blood pressure, and diabetes. To escape a burnout spiral, try these 6 sanity-saving tweaks to your routine. Number 1, if you do this, check your inbox from bed. Do this instead. Take deep, focused breaths. Sure, getting a head start on work is well-intentioned, but it can set off your body's stress response. That can cause those feelings of early morning dread and anxiety that fuel burnout. Adding stressful stimuli into the mix, when your cortisol levels are already high, doesn't set you up for starting your day off calm, focused, and centered. As an alternative, try 1 minute of deep, slow breathing before getting out of bed. This will hack your nervous system so you feel calmer. If meditation, morning run, yoga, or another soothing practice is more your speed, do that instead. anything that helps you relax and recognize when you've lost that chill later in the day will be beneficial. If you wake up late, do this instead. Make time for a morning commute. Experts argue that imitating your pre-work-from-home habits can improve your mental health. Through a behavioral lens, all the activities that constituted your pre-work routine prime your brain to begin your workday. There are powerful gestures of association that calibrate your mind and body to transition to work mode. Doctors recommend a walk around the block to prepare for the day ahead. Aim to create other similar experiences from your pandemic routine, like reading the newspaper. If you do this, put off big projects. Do this instead. Rearrange your routine. Another common side effect of lockdowns is that many of us feel as if we have more time than we do, so we put off what we can do. Don't do it. In fact, doctors recommend scheduling your most challenging tasks around the time you've had your first coffee. While study results vary, experts say your peak mental focus is somewhere between 10 a.m. and 11 a.m. But it's crucial to adjust your expectations and acknowledge that productivity can drop off throughout the day. Our brains are not machines. We can't expect the same level of output when we continue to push ourselves all day long. If you do this, scroll on your smartphone after hours. Do this instead. Recharge and reboot. Resilience isn't about how you endure. It's about how you recharge. Unfortunately, many of us have gotten lazy about our leisure time. Instead of engaging in what experts describe as true leisure, like going for a run in the park, we engage in conspiratory leisure, like having a beer late in the day, or spillover leisure, like scanning social media on the couch. You need to focus on activities that fuel your soul and fill your capacity again. Spend time outside or plan a home workout, anything to get you moving, even if you're stuck in the great indoors. If you do this, work like a hermit and become a recluse. Do this instead. Make connections. Without a social working environment, staying in contact requires more effort, but it's still important. Send a text message to a friend about playing fantasy football, or plan a working lunch with colleagues. Not only will they appreciate the gesture, you will also feel better for having the interaction. And recognize your and others' wins, too. We get a feel-good hit of dopamine in our brains from our celebrating wins. For example, drop a message into a Slack channel at work to broadcast your success. And finally, if you do this, stay on Slack 24/7. Do this instead. Create boundaries. When you work in an office, you have a physical end to your day once you leave your workplace. When you work from home, you might be tempted to keep working with no end in sight. Research shows that one way to combat burnout is role compartmentalization, or simply creating boundaries. Look for ways to detach from work, such as shutting down your computer at the end of the day, muting your Slack notifications, minimizing work on the weekends, and changing into play clothes. London Business School and Cornell University researchers found that working on days off negatively affected motivation and could lead to lower overall job satisfaction. If you must, mentally reframe work on weekends as work time rather than time off, and it can help stave off any loss of motivation. Next, America's sleepiest cities. Poor sleep can lead to heightened risk of diabetes, hypertension, and obesity. And if you just fell asleep reading the sentence, well, where you live may be to blame. We analyzed 100 of the largest U.S. cities and scored each according to the bedtimes of its residents and how many of them reported sleeping less than 7 hours a night on average. We also factored in how many people suffered from health concerns related to lack of sleep. Issues such as obesity, physical inactivity, smoking, and excessive drinking. After we slept on everything, we ranked the places where you can't and can rest easy. Who are the sleepiest cities, 1 to 10? Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Toledo, Ohio. New Orleans, Louisiana. Detroit, Michigan. Cincinnati, Ohio. Lexington, Kentucky. Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Las Vegas, Nevada. Jacksonville, Florida. And finally, number 10, Providence, Rhode Island. The most refreshed cities, from 91 to 100, Minneapolis, Minnesota, Lincoln, Nebraska, Salt Lake City, Utah, Madison, Wisconsin, San Francisco, California, Burlington, Vermont, Denver, Colorado, Colorado Springs, Aurora, Colorado, and number 100 most refreshed, Boise, Idaho. So sleepiest is Philadelphia. Philly scored poorly in all assessments. Its residents don't get enough sleep, go to bed just before midnight on average, and have high inactivity ratings. One explanation, enough darkness can make your circadian rhythms go screwy. And Philadelphia suffers from some of the worst light pollution in the U.S. Number 8 on the list, Las Vegas. The 24-hour party requires around-the-clock employees. And research shows that night shift workers are at greater risk of developing asthma, depression, and heart disease, the last of which may be partly due to irregular diet habits that may or may not involve it, the all-you-can-eat buffets and such. It's hard to change your shift, but it's easy to pack a breakfast. And finally, 99, Aurora, Colorado. You go, Colorado. Colorado placed 3 cities on our best rested rankings. Maybe because only 27% of Coloradans report sleeping less than 7 hours a night on average. Residents go above and beyond the guidelines for physical activity. Moderate intensity aerobic exercise for at least 150 minutes per week and muscle strengthening activities on 2 days a week. Well, we come to the end of our program. I've been reading Men's Health magazine. I'm Peter Gilmore. This has been a production of Sight and Sound Radio, Houston, Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center's Psychiatry Department will host free virtual monthly webinars covering multiple mental and behavioral health concerns. Each month, the public can join in through Zoom and listen to TTUHSC physicians and residents speak on topics ranging from depression, autism in children, PTSD, eating disorders, and much more. The public can find more information on TTUHSC Permian Basin's Facebook page or by emailing pbhyphen@ttuhsc.edu.
This week on the Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Saturday Night Movie, we continue our series of Oscar-winning films. Each week, we're selecting one audio-described movie from each decade leading up to this year's Academy Awards broadcast on April 25th. Saturday, we enter the 70s with the 1971 action thriller, The French Connection. It won the awards for Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Director, Best Film Editing, and Best Adapted Screenplay, and was nominated for 3 others.
All right, Popeye's here. Get your hands on your heads. Get off the bar and get on the wall. What's my name?
Popeye Doyle. If he doesn't like you, he'll take you apart. And it's all perfectly legal, because Doyle fights dirty.
You want to take a ride there, fat man?
And plays rough.
Anybody want a milkshake?
Doyle is bad news, but he's a good cop.
We're going now. Bye.
What about the last of big time spenders? You make it?
No, you.
He's spreading it around like the Russians are in Jersey. They say we stick around and give him a tail.
Our friend's name is Boca, Salvatore Boca, B-O-C-A. The French Connection. A millionaire exporter with a record too clean to be true, and Doyle knows it. But he's been known to make mistakes.
Your hunches have backfired before, Doyle.
This time, he
can't afford to be wrong.
Let me bust, Bob! I want to bust!
I know the deal hasn't gone down. I know it hasn't. I can feel it. I'm dead certain.
Last time you're dead certain, we end up a dead cop.
All right, let's hit him.
All right, nobody move. Put your hands in the air.
The stakeout.
All right. It's me. It's me.
The payoff. The chase.
Don't stop.
All right!
French Connection.
Gene Hackman and Roy Scheider.